Trump and Putin BFFs today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Donald Trump calls Vladimir Putin a strong leader. Putin calls Trump bright. This reporter says it's a bromance for the ages.
I've been saying for months that whenever Trump opens his mouth and says something, I'm going, okay, where have I heard this before? Who does he remind me of? And I'm always like, oh, of course, it's Vladimir Putin.
Plus, world soccer's top officials get banned, but rooting out corruption in the sport won't happen overnight.
So the main task remaining will be to change the culture, and that will take time.
And an Irish woman wants to teach English in Korea, but she's told,
no, I'm going to blacklist you with all the recruiters. You're never going to get a job in Korea. You don't speak English.
Not the right kind of English. All that's coming up today on The World. It's good to be back with you from my perch here in Boston after 2 weeks in Kenya. I met so many inspiring people there, and you heard many of their stories here on the show. But I didn't tell you about my run-in with Kenyan police last week in Nairobi. It wasn't serious. I had taken some pictures in a shopping mall where apparently I wasn't supposed to, and the officers insisted I delete them. I was informed later by a reliable person that the police were basically looking for what's known in Swahili as kitu kidogo. Best translation, a little something-something, a bribe. Corruption happens in many places around the globe, and actually that is where we kick things off today. Corruption, and specifically corruption in soccer. Sepp Blatter's corruption. Blatter is the head of FIFA, soccer's world governing body, or maybe we should say was the head of FIFA, because today the organization's own ethics committee banned Blatter from the sport for 8 years. The world soccer guy William Troop is here to tell us what Blatter did to deserve that sentence.
Well, Sepp Blatter issued a payment of roughly $2 million to another soccer official, the head of the European Soccer Confederation, Michel Platini. And this payment was not recorded in the FIFA books. It was not declared to anybody. It was just, according to the two of them, a gentleman's agreement. But the ethics committee at FIFA, which is now taking these ethics allegations very, very seriously under enormous pressure from the outside world, decided that they weren't convinced by that explanation.
Now, $2 million is a lot, but there have been a lot of other things that FIFA is accused of doing over the years. It doesn't seem that big a graft.
This does seem relatively minor, but I think what happened here is that when looking at a picture of rampant corruption allegations that really are found everywhere in the FIFA world, the ethics committee at FIFA decided that this is what they could prove. So it may not be the most glaring, brazen act of corruption, but it certainly seemed unethical, and the explanations offered by Blatter and Platini just didn't cut it.
All right, so now the president of FIFA has been banned from the sport. Is Blatter going to fight this?
Oh, most certainly. I mean, today he gave a very defiant press conference. His statements, you know, were a bit rambling. He was unshaven. He looked like a kind of crazed man. And he said, basically, the only thing he's sorry for is that he's being treated like a punching ball, he said it, like a punching bag for world soccer, and that he was going to be back. How he's going to do that, I'm not quite sure, because this looks like quite a blow to his aspirations to ever be involved in soccer again.
William, we're talking about a sports organization here, but clearly authorities in at least two countries, the U.S. and Switzerland, seem to be speaking in a way that this goes far beyond just sports. Why is that?
Yeah, I think it's because, you know, when you look at the efforts to end corruption anywhere, you can't really say, well, corruption is not good in this country or that country, and then allow a major organization like FIFA to behave in this manner. And Loretta Lynch, the U.S. Attorney General, actually made a reference to this earlier this month when she announced a new round of indictments in her investigation. Let's hear that.
The Department of Justice is committed to ending the rampant corruption that we have described amidst the leadership of international soccer, not only because of the brazenness and the breadth of the operation required to sustain such corruption, but also because of the affront to international principles that this behavior represents.
Yeah, and Lynch actually went further and said that international sports represents something that is universal. It represents humanitarian values. It's the way we teach our children about fair play and good character. It's emblematic of the understanding of nations of what's allowed and not allowed, what's legal, what's proper. So she clearly gave a point of view that this goes well beyond the sport itself and really speaks to, you know, what is considered good conduct anywhere.
That was the world soccer guy William Troop. Now, Sylvia Schenk is special advisor on sports for the corruption watchdog group Transparency International. She joins me from Frankfurt, Germany. You've worked with FIFA in the past to help the organization battle corruption, Ms. Schenk. How badly does FIFA rank in terms of corruption when you look at other sports organizations?
Well, with regard to governance, FIFA is not so bad. With regard to corruption cases, FIFA has had quite a lot in the past, but has already started now the reform process.
Yeah, what does that reform process actually entail? Like, what are they doing that you feel is good, is right?
Well, there is a real package as a proposal for the Congress, the Extraordinary Congress, end of February next year. And as far as I see it, that's quite comprehensive. The main issue will be that it takes time for implementation and for really changing the culture within FIFA, and not just within FIFA itself, but as well within the continental federations and the national federations. And that's a huge challenge.
Can I just ask you, why has corruption been so hard to root out within FIFA, do you think?
Well, in the beginning, for quite a long time, the public, even the media, were not very critical on FIFA and did not really care. It just changed some years ago, but that's the same in all other areas of life. If you look back about 20, 25 years, corruption was not on the international agenda then. It just started in the 90s that countries started to fight corruption. We had a lot of corruption for a long time.
I mean, corruption is not good anywhere, but why in a sports organization is it so important? Why does it matter?
Because sport organizations are seen as something that has to do with fair play. Sport organizations are very important to educate the youth. They should be a good example, and especially the Olympic Games, and as well, I think, football on the international level and the FIFA World Cup. They should be seen as big events that support peace, that supports the understanding between people, and of course fair play once again. So if even sport is received as corrupt, then it's a big problem, because then people will lose all their hope into sports and into fair play on the whole.
So if FIFA were just to disappear completely and you replace it with another governing body, is it guaranteed that another one would just become as corrupt as FIFA?
Well, I don't know whether as corrupt or less corrupt, but in international sport, you will have very big corruption risks all the time. You have it in all sports, and you have to deal with it appropriately.
And for you, what is the key thing to do that would be most appropriate to stop corruption?
Well, to have the right statutes and regulations in place, that's one point. Second point is to have the right persons in the leadership. And third point is the overall culture. So there are three things you have to work on. So the main task remaining will be to change the culture, and that will take time.
Sylvia Schenk, Special Advisor on Sports for Transparency International. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Talk about an unlikely bromance, Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. Last week, Putin described Trump as bright and talented. Trump repaid the compliment, saying Putin was a strong, powerful leader. Moscow-based writer Natalia Antonova has been following the courtship, as it were. What do these guys actually see in each other, Natalia?
Oh, well, you know, I shouldn't pat myself on the back, first of all, but I'm totally going to, because I've been saying for months that whenever Trump opens his mouth and says something, I'm going, okay, where have I heard this before? Who does he remind me of? And I'm always like, oh, of course, it's Vladimir Putin. They are so alike. So it's actually, it's so, you know, completely predictable and so natural for these two to kind of, you know, have a love fest at this point, because they both play on people's fears. They both play on people's insecurities. You know, Putin gave rise to the saying that Russia's getting up off its knees, and now Trump is going, you know, make America great again. And they're basically appealing to the same kinds of people. So it makes perfect sense for them to now be complimenting each other.
And what for you in the last few months was the most memorable Trump sounding like Putin moment?
Oh, dear, this is really hard. You know, I'd have I should probably go with like a top 10 or something. But, well, you know, one of the things that I really felt Trump, you know, one of the things that he does well, like Putin, is that he's always inspiring people to look for the enemy, you know, in the room or outside the room or whatever. But there's always this sense of, you know, it's us versus them. And, you know, we're the good guys, we're the elves, we're the warriors of light or whatever. And his entire persona, I think, hinges on conflict. And, you know, this is what Putin does, too. And also just the kind of pseudo folksy stuff. I mean, Trump, you know, he comes from a wealthy family. Putin actually kind of had to work quite a bit to get where he's at today. But still, there is that, you know, it's an appeal to authenticity. Like when Trump insults someone horribly, like when he was insulting, a journalist with a disability, you know, just to give one example, he falls back on this whole issue of, hey, I'm just being honest. And Putin really does the same thing. He can say really just sort of, you know, people would say unbecoming, quote unquote, things. You know, like he recently at his big presser was saying that, oh, the Turks, they wanted to lick the Americans in a certain spot. Mm. And, you know, like as a big time politician, as a, you know, a leader of a country, like, you know, is it OK to say that? Well, as Putin would tell you, hey, I'm just keeping it real. And they really do. They have this very similar style where they're just, you know, they're like two boys sitting around their backyard, you know, just kind of like having beers and just keeping it real. That's their whole appeal, I think.
Yeah, and despite all the negative things and sometimes wacky things that come out of their mouths, they're still very popular. Is that, do you think, because people see them just shooting from the hip?
Well, yeah, I think there is that. I also, I mean, I might get in trouble for saying this, but I do think that Russians have more of an excuse to like Putin, because honestly, Russia has never had a highly functioning political system. Russia went through an absolute mess in the 20th century. You know, the first half was completely brutal. And I think Russian society is deeply traumatized, is suffering from PTSD. And there's a sense of insecurity that someone like Putin can really draw on, you know, and I think that Americans do not have, they don't have nearly as much of an excuse to be insecure.
How sincere do you think both of them are?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to tell with any politician when he or she is being sincere. But of course, with Putin, I think Putin possibly way less sincere than Trump, just because even if Trump gets elected, Putin is still going to need the Americans to be the bad guys and the boogeymen. And there's no way that if Trump is elected, I really don't see him just being, oh, you know, Americans are our friends now.
Now, Putin used a Russian word to describe Trump as bright, but I understand this word also has some other meanings, too.
Well, actually, the exact words he used were ochen yarky, which means very bright. But bright, look, when people call each other yarky in Russian, they don't mean bright in an intellectual sense. What they mean is that it's someone who turns heads, who is very, you know, unusual, not in a weird way, but just kind of a very noticeable person, someone who draws attention, someone who's different in a way. And I think that's what he meant when he was describing Trump.
So what do the ordinary people in Moscow think about this bromance, if we can call it that, between Putin and Trump?
I think that people really do want to believe that Trump is going to come in and be this great friend to Russia, someone who, you know, will treat them as a superpower and say nice things about them. Russians really, really care what foreigners think of them. And so in that sense, yeah, I think that they're excited about Trump.
Journalist and writer Natalia Antonova in Moscow, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up later in the show, the Chinese get to know Houston, Texas, through former NBA center Yao Ming.
When Yao Ming started playing, the Houston Rockets games became the most watched games on the planet, because the NBA was broadcasting these games in China.
Now Houston's trying to cash in, reaching out to Chinese tourists. Listen in. That's coming up later on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Many parents in South Korea want their kids to learn English, and they prefer that their children be taught by native English speakers. That has shaped the market for teachers of ESL, or English as a Second Language, in South Korea. Right now, there are more than 20,000 instructors from around the English-speaking world teaching in Korean schools. But not all accents and nationalities are equally welcome, as we hear from Jason Strother.
I met up with Eve Coffey in a cafe just ahead of her afternoon class. The 23-year-old studied linguistics back home in Ireland and teaches ESL to middle and high school students here now. But she says when she started applying for jobs in South Korea last year through a local recruiter, it didn't go so well.
I don't think he had read my CV or anything, because when he came on to Skype with me, he said, oh, where are you? And I said, oh, I'm in Ireland. And he said, oh, Irish people speak English? I was like, yes, Irish people speak English.
Coffey says while talking to the man, she tried to speak clearly and not sound too Irish. But that all went out the window when she turned away from the computer and started speaking to her mom in a mix of Irish and her natural brogue.
And he said, "You're not an English speaker." And I said, "I've obviously displayed that I am an English speaker." And he's like, "You said you spoke English." And I said, "I do speak English. You can hear me speaking English now." And he said, "No, I'm going to blacklist you with all the recruiters. You're never going to get a job in Korea. You don't speak English."
There was no blacklisting, and Coffey quickly found a job through another recruiter.
Can someone tell me...
South Korean law only allows nationals from seven English-speaking countries, including Ireland, South Africa, and Australia, to teach ESL.
What takes its place?
Cool air.
Yes, cool air.
But some teachers who aren't from the U.S. or Canada say schools won't hire instructors with their accents. I've heard that some bosses will even tell non-North Americans to fake an American accent in the classroom. Many South Koreans prefer the American accent over others because of their country's historical and cultural ties with the United States, says Jasper Kim, who lectures at Seoul's Ewha Women's University. He says this preference fulfills an academic objective, too.
Well, I think for many South Koreans, having the American accent means it's the right path. And so the American accent is a ticket to get the children to where they want them to be, which is, in essence, the Ivy Leagues. Anything else just wouldn't make sense to many, but not all Koreans. So that's why there's a preference for the American accent.
Some tutoring schools in Seoul specifically advertise they teach North American English.
What do you want me to say?
What do you want me to say?
Attending one of these institutes that employs North American English speakers is 27-year-old Kim Gon-young. He says he plans to do an MBA in the U.S., so that's why he wants to become more familiar with the American accent. I mentioned to him that not all Americans sound the same. He says he knows the difference between American and British English, like Americans say water, and British people say water. But he says he's not that familiar with all the different regional accents in the U.S. Kevin Kang, director of the Sweet English Language Institute, says the curriculum is based on what some phonetic textbooks refer to as standard American English. Kang, who has a background in speech pathology, says accents really don't matter, despite what some Koreans think. Consistent pronunciation is more important.
It doesn't need to be an American accent or a British accent or an Australian accent. As long as once the learner actually stick to one certain language, actually, that would improve their sound a lot.
He gives me an example of a sound that Koreans just can't get right, the difference between an R and L.
We only have one sound for them, ryu. So, for example, can you guess what I said? Like, did you read it? Did you read it?
Could be read, could be lead.
Yeah, could be read or could be lead.
It's a big problem with the word rice.
Yeah, sure, yeah, it could be lice.
To help students improve their North American accents, Kang School is developing a smartphone app called SoundFit.
The app itself is showing what...
Product manager James Jin walks me through it.
And how they sound and how...
The screen shows a front and side view of an animated mouth.
Like in the word eat is produced by positioning the tongue forward and high in the mouth. The jaw is in an...
Not everyone agrees with the school's approach. ESL teacher Eve Coffey says students should be exposed to a range of voices. It's rare that they'll meet an English speaker who has what's considered the ideal accent. She says that's benefited some of her students.
I had a couple of students saying, "Oh, you don't sound English and you don't sound American. Like, what are you?" But that's just, they're confused about where the accent comes from.
Coffey adds another student has actually picked up some of her Irish accent. For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Jinju, South Korea.
And Jason talks about his struggles with various Korean dialects in our podcast, The World in Words. You can hear that at pri.org/language. Miss Colombia and Miss Philippines, I know everyone's talking about Steve Harvey's mistake at the Miss Universe pageant. No one seems to be saying anything, though, about Miss Hungary. You know, the contestant who came out with an exploding Rubik's Cube hat and Rubik's Cube bathing suit, which is the perfect segue to a little appreciation of one of the hottest-selling toys ever. People used to obsess, still do in fact, for days, even weeks, trying to get each of the six sides to be one solid color.
Sure, Sir Isaac Newton unraveled the mysteries of gravity, but could he have unraveled the mysteries of Rubik's Cube?
Today, there are still contests to unravel the mysteries of Rubik's Cube all over the world. In Cape Town, just last week, a 15-year-old broke a record in South Africa for completing the puzzle in 5.25 seconds. Still not better than the American kid, a 14-year-old, who solved it last month in 4.9 seconds. Becoming the world's fastest solver, for now anyway. And then there was that weird Rubik's Cube headdress worn last night by Miss Hungary. Hey, Rubik's Cube may be the best national symbol of Hungary, better than goulash and the Gabor sisters at this point anyway. Erno Rubik is a Hungarian architect, designer, and was a professor in Budapest. He came up with the idea when he was trying to help his students understand spatial awareness.
I was interested to create something that is mobile, simple, and contains some kind of task.
Once he got individual pieces to move around the cube, he was ready to test it out on his students.
They liked it very much, and it's a very interesting task. And I was searching different potential of the cube, and I believe finally I was successful.
It actually took Erno Rubik several months to solve his own creation. It's a puzzle for the 1%, not the rich, the 1% of the world with the brain capacity to solve the cube without any help. When it was first invented, it was sold only in Hungary, and there was no advertising. Remember, this was the Cold War. Hungary was under communist rule. And the cube actually became a kind of currency for Erno Rubik.
Partly because it was hardly available. It was a good business to buy some, take it abroad, and sell it there.
Erno Rubik did find a distributor in the U.S., and over the next 40 years, more than 350 million Rubik's Cubes were sold all over the world. Rubik made money from his invention, though not as much as he could have. But then again, money isn't everything. Rubik always maintained that for him, it was just something he enjoyed making and spending time solving. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Tourists love to go to Texas to learn about cowboys.
They're straight shooting, they're hardworking, they're honest, but if you cross them, look out.
Lately, more and more Chinese are visiting the Lone Star State. Find out what else brings them there, plus how Big Pharma benefits from a new trade agreement. That's all ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The U.S. has one of the best healthcare systems on the planet, but as we all know, it's not without some major downsides. And we're going to hear about two of them in this part of the program. In a moment, the surprisingly high rate of infant mortality here in the U.S. We begin, though, by looking at the high cost of drugs and why that's an American problem that may soon be exported around the globe. Turns out there's a provision in the recently negotiated Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, that could have that effect. Tim Fernholz has written about this for Quartz.
When a health agency like the FDA here in the U.S. approves a medicine to be sold in its country, it does so on the basis of big clinical tests, and those cost a ton of money and take a long time to do. So if I'm a big pharmaceutical company and I, you know, patent and then get approval on my drug, Timoseptin, you know, I don't want anyone else to be able to use that test trial to approve their drug. What the TPP does is it makes it impossible for a generic drug company to get approval of their drug based on the main company's tests. And that makes it a lot more costly for them to bring a generic drug to market and effectively extends the monopoly that the original pharmaceutical company has. Without competition from a generic provider, and this is ultimately what people are worried about, the prices are going to be higher for everyday drugs.
And is there an assumption that generics would come from developing countries?
It's not just an assumption. It's a reality. Right now, developing countries lead the world in manufacturing generic drugs, India in particular, though it's not a party to this deal. But what the drug companies are basically afraid of and why the U.S. felt like it had a justification in negotiating this, is the big drug companies are mostly in the U.S., but these big drug companies own their intellectual property, and that's where they get their money from. And they basically want to protect it and get as much money out of it as they can. And in countries that don't have the same laws as the U.S., like Australia or New Zealand or Vietnam before the TPP, their competitors with generic drugs could bring them on the market much faster because they could say, hey, my drug is the same as theirs, and you already did the big tests with all their data to make sure it's safe, so let me in. What the pharmaceutical companies, the big ones in the U.S., have said, no, everybody's got to play by the same rules and not use my data tests for 5 years, for 8 years. We wish it was 12, so I can be the only person in the market. As a result of trade deals like the Central American Free Trade Pact that inspired a lot of the language in TPP, you've seen in like a country like Chile, drug prices have gone up because of similar protections included in the deal.
So what does this mean for countries like Vietnam and Peru and Chile?
So what critics of these policies, Doctors Without Borders, basically says, we're going to see drug prices for critical drugs become higher in these countries. And one, I think, good example is in Indonesia right now. Indonesia is not part of the TPP, but it has already announced that it wants to join. There was a deal approved where a German pharmaceutical company was going to partner with an Indonesian firm to make a generic version, or what you would call a biosimilar, of the drug Herceptin, which is a really popular anti-breast cancer drug right now. Mm. However, under the TPP rules, it would be much harder for them to do that in Indonesia because they would need to access the test data, and it would be exclusive if Indonesia adopts these rules. So there's an example where you could see a generic drug for breast cancer coming to market in Indonesia faster and cheaper, but if they join the TPP, it's going to be harder and it's going to be more expensive for them to bring it to market.
So is the U.S. essentially exporting high pharmaceutical prices under TPP? And how does the White House justify that?
You would certainly say it appears to be doing so. At some point, we should note that the pharmaceutical companies do make the case that it's important to protect the investments that they make, the billions of dollars they spend on researching these drugs. And there is, at a certain extent, it's important to do that, to create this incentive. But I think most neutral observers agree that they're skewed too far in the direction of the companies. What the White House is thinking with this is twofold. One is that the U.S. advantage in the global economy, just to be very ruthless about it, is intellectual property, very advanced research, what these pharmaceutical companies do. And so the U.S. views anything it can do to protect its big national companies as a good thing. The second issue is that as part of passing the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, the Obama administration made a deal with the pharmaceutical companies to set that 12-year level of data protection for biologic drugs. Now, you can tell they regret that because every year since, they've proposed shortening it to 7, but they haven't been able to. So they sort of made a deal with the devil to get healthcare through in the U.S., but it's led to higher standard in the U.S. that's now being exported around the world.
Tim Fernholz with Quartz, thank you very much for explaining this to us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Tim mentioned the advanced research that our medical system is known for, and it's kind of mind-boggling how we can have such an advanced system and still have a problem with infant mortality in this country. The U.S. has a rate of about 6 infant deaths for every 1,000 live births. That's more than twice as high as the infant mortality rate in Japan or Finland, for example. And that's despite a recent report from the Centers for Disease Control that signaled a small reduction in infant mortality here. So why are we still lagging behind so many other nations? Emily Oster is an associate professor at Brown University who studied infant mortality.
So I think it's difficult to tell. So what we find in our paper is that, yes, indeed, you know, well-off women in the U.S. are similarly have similar mortality rates to women elsewhere, and that really what's going on in the data is that poor women in the U.S., particularly in the period between 1 and 12 months of life, so the period when the infant is at home and where a lot of deaths are occurring in the home, that's the group and the time period that really drives a lot of our high infant mortality rates. There are a lot of explanations for that. And one possibility is differences in healthcare access. Another possibility is differences in maternity leave, differences in other kinds of resources. And all of these things may play an important role.
So tell us what other countries are doing right, not just for wealthy women, but for all women across the board, especially if the U.S. is lagging behind in last place of 27 wealthy countries.
So I'll give you one example of something that struck us that's very different between the U.S. and most countries in Europe, which is most places in Europe have universal home visiting programs. So when you go home with your baby, somebody comes to your house. typically more than one time, and they see how things are going and they help you with things that you're struggling with and they give you advice. There's a little bit of that in the US and it's become more common, but it's certainly not as uniform as it is elsewhere. And I think that many people cite that as an important difference in terms of the infrastructure and the help that women are getting after they're home with their babies, not so much in the hospital, but once you're at home and trying to figure out how to do things right.
You're saying that's for women all across the board, like in other countries in Europe. I mean, poor women, they also get longer maternity leave, for example.
Yeah, there are many things that are different across the board. And I think one of the things that goes on is that wealthy women have a lot of ways in the U.S. to get support that is not accessible to poor women. And elsewhere, there's more uniformity in the kinds of help that people are getting. And there's less inequality in general. And that probably plays an important role.
You know, it's crazy. I was just in Kenya for 2 weeks and we were doing a story about getting women to prenatal visits using incentives like, you know, sweet potatoes, orange flesh sweet potatoes. It almost sounds like for some women in the United States, we need to have a similar program here.
Yeah, I mean, I think getting people in for more prenatal visits is crucial. And I think it's not so much about incentives, but about making it easy, making it accessible, making it something you don't have to sit and wait for, you know, 5 hours in a clinic to see somebody. We want to make those things really easy.
So you mentioned the home visiting programs, which sounds, gosh, kind of luxurious. What else are poor U.S. pregnant mothers missing here that they might get, say, if they lived in Sweden or somewhere in Europe?
They are getting fewer prenatal visits. Why exactly that's true, I think, is unclear. In many of these other countries, you get gifts. The government will send you, like in Finland, which is one of the countries we study, the government sends you this box of stuff. And it's like clothes and diapers and so on. Obviously, we're not doing that here. Does that really matter? I think it's hard to tell. And I think that this is so wrapped up in a lot of other issues of poverty and inequality. It's hard to point to a particular behavior and say, aha, this is the thing that's going to make a difference.
As you've studied this, have you seen any inclination in this country to really having a comprehensive healthcare program from conception all the way through those postnatal months?
I think there are pushes in this direction. I mean, in terms of the medical care during pregnancy and, you know, during the birth, you know, Medicaid covers poor women. In terms of postnatal stuff, as I said, I think that there's a push towards trying to have more support postnatally, but that is still really getting off the ground. And that's something that a lot of people are working on, but not in a uniform way.
Emily Oster, who is at Brown University just down the road from us in Providence, Rhode Island. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
China's economy is cooling off, but that has not stopped globe-trotting Chinese tourists from sightseeing. In fact, Chinese tourists are expected to become the third largest group of foreign visitors to the U.S. after Mexicans and Canadians, and cities across the U.S. are trying to cash in. The World's Jason Margolis visited Houston, where Chinese tourism is booming.
Come to the George Ranch just outside of Houston and take a step back in time to the 1820s. A reenactor asks elementary school kids if they want to be cowboys or cowgirls here.
How many of y'all want 7 square miles of Texas in a 12-year tax break?
Me!
It's a cool way to learn Texas history. Nick Castleberg plays Cookie, the chef on a cattle drive. Besides making the food, Cookie was the doctor. Best to stay on his good side to get the good medicine.
And it's up to me which medicine you get when you get ill. So if you've been bad-mouthing my cooking, you're not getting whiskey. You're getting cod liver oil.
Castleberg's audience isn't just kids, though. There are visitors from all over. Britain, France, Australia, and increasingly...
lots of Chinese. Yeah, yeah, steady flow.
I asked Castleberg why. He says cowboys hold a universal appeal.
They're straight shooting. They're hardworking. They're honest. But if you cross them, look out.
Still, if I'm a Chinese tourist planning my once-in-a-lifetime or even twice-in-a-lifetime trip to the U.S., I'm hitting L.A., New York, or Vegas, baby. Sorry. Houston has the world's widest freeway, 26 lanes across, for real. Are Chinese tourists really going to choose Houston or, I don't know, Cleveland?
Cleveland, actually, you say that. There are Chinese ending up there. We see a lot of Chinese ending up in Kentucky, in St. Louis, in Portland.
Evan Saunders is CEO of Attract China, a company that helps American cities and businesses market to Chinese tourists. He says, yes, Chinese travelers first visit New York, L.A., and Vegas. But when they come back to the U.S., they want to tell their friends in China, guess where I've been that you haven't?
With photographs attached to it. So they get to really be the pioneers in that way.
That might help explain why 63,000 Chinese visitors chose to visit Houston last year, more than triple the number from the year before. It helps that there's now a direct flight from Beijing. That's huge. It also helps to get lucky.
Ladies and gentlemen, New York, Houston Rockets!
A few years ago, the Houston Rockets drafted Chinese megastar 7-foot-6-inch center Yao Ming. This was a gift from heaven to George Franz. He works with Visit Houston, the city's tourism office.
When Yao Ming started playing, the Houston Rockets games became the most watched games on the planet because the NBA was broadcasting these games in China.
Yao retired in 2011, but his legacy endures. I met Franz at the Yao restaurant and bar where Norman Chow is the assistant manager. Chow says 3 tour buses a month come here packed with Chinese visitors. The food is good, but people really come here to ooh and ah at the display cases.
We have basketball and Yao Ming's shoes, size 17.
Size 17?
Size 17, that's right.
There's other cool stuff in Houston, museums and the NASA Space Center.
We can touch the rock.
Meaning a piece of moon rock. I saw Asian tourists at various stops in Houston. Most weren't up for an interview in English, though. Research shows Chinese visitors are really visiting Houston first and foremost to shop.
I'm Andrew Wong, the director of marketing with the Galleria, which is the 4th largest mall in the United States.
The mall has nearly 400 stores, 2 hotels, and is undergoing a $250 million expansion. Everything bigger in Texas. Still, I was skeptical. A mall is a mall, right? Not to a foreign shopper in Texas. They can take their receipts to the tax-free office right there at the shopping center.
They will refund your taxes, and then you can actually go back and shop some more with the taxes that you just received back. So it's a pretty good deal for international travelers.
Chinese tourists recently became the mall's biggest foreign shoppers by far. Stores are hiring Mandarin-speaking sales staff to cater to them. Local hotels are also tailoring to Chinese visitors, like the upscale St. Regis in Houston.
2 of our floors are butler floors, where we have butlers that pack and unpack the guest luggage.
Matthew Vesely shows me around. Everybody here is treated like a VIP, but Vesely says the staff goes a little further for their Chinese guests.
When you travel domestically in China, most of the Chinese will not travel with their toothbrush, because they'll be getting a toothbrush at their hotel, wherever they're staying. But they don't necessarily know that when they come to America, there's not going to be a toothbrush waiting for them in the room. So we make sure that we have that toiletry kit for them.
Houston might not knock off New York anytime soon as America's most popular tourist destination. But if you meet someone from China who knows a lot about cowboys or the complexities of the Houston Rockets' offense, don't be too surprised. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis, Houston.
A quick look ahead now to a story we'll have for you tomorrow on The World. It's about a psychologist who advocates for refugees. Luna Mulder was born in Bhutan, but she grew up in New York. Each summer, she would visit her cousins. They were growing up in Nepal as refugees.
You know, they only had 1 article of clothing per year, the refugees, if you can imagine that. So we had our little backpack, you know, that we would take for the summer with, like, maybe a few skirts and T-shirts, and that was it. And that, to them, was just like, how can you even wear all those clothes? Why do you need so much for one person?
Now, Luna Mulder helps other refugees resettle in the United States. After all, she was almost a refugee herself. Her story tomorrow. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Just a beginning, that's what pretty much everyone is saying about the big climate deal reached this month in Paris. All 196 countries at the Paris talks signed on to the agreement, including poor and developing countries that will be among the hardest hit by the climate crisis. But despite that unanimity, there's a lot of debate in the developing world about whether the agreement was a step forward or a step back. The World's Carolyn Beeler spoke with 2 South Asian men deeply involved in climate policy, and they have very different reads of the same document.
In this story, Salim Al-Haq is going to play the glass-half-full guy.
I think it was a much better and a much more ambitious agreement than we had expected going into Paris.
Haq is a Bangladeshi and longtime advisor to the Least Developed Countries Group. That's the negotiating bloc that represents 48 of the world's poorest countries at the UN climate talks.
The biggest thing is that we have all countries working together to fight the problem, not just some.
That is a very big change from previous agreements, which largely broke down along lines of rich and poor countries. But Huck says success isn't just about everyone being involved. There's also a very specific win in Paris for the developing world.
We were able to change the long-term temperature goal from 2 degrees to 1.5 degrees, which matters to the most vulnerable and the poorest countries very much.
That's because that 0.5 degree Celsius could make the difference between things like an island nation disappearing or not, or a country being able to grow enough food. But holding warming to 1.5 degrees is a much harder target than 2 degrees. And before the summit, Huck says the idea wasn't getting any traction in the international community.
Going into Paris, neither the rich countries like the US or Europeans or even the large developing countries like China and India were prepared to change it to 1.5 degrees. That was something that we were able to persuade them to do over the 2 weeks.
Now, that 1.5 degree target is just a long-term goal. And so far, countries' actual pledges to cut carbon emissions have the Earth on track to warm roughly 3 degrees Celsius. They'll have to seriously up the ante in the years ahead. But Huck says it's a vital start.
There are many things that are not right about where we are at the moment. But what Paris does, in my view, and which is why I would say it's an achievement, is that it puts everybody on the right path. We are not fighting each other anymore. We are going together.
Okay, now for our glass half empty guy.
The reality in the cold light of day is that it is a huge great escape for the big polluters and ultimately a poison chalice for the poor.
Like Salim Ul Haq, Asad Rahman is from South Asia. He's a Pakistani-born Brit with the grassroots environmental group Friends of the Earth International. He sees the Paris Agreement as little more than a face-saving document from an international community desperate for a win.
After the debacle of Copenhagen, many, many people felt that we needed a successful outcome in Paris.
Rahman says the nod to a 1.5 degree limit doesn't mean much, and he says there are other huge holes in the deal, particularly the language on financing. Aid from richer countries to poorer ones to help fight climate change and deal with its effects. The plan sets a floor of $100 billion in aid by year 2025, but it doesn't specify that the money will have to be new and additional, which Rahman sees as creating a big loophole.
Now that money is simply going to be repackaged and called climate finance. So in the best case scenario, it's robbing Peter to pay Paul. In the worst case scenario, it's just literally any money that you're spending in any quarters just being relabeled as climate finance.
In other words, Rahman thinks talk of all that new aid is largely an empty promise. And while he understands the urge to celebrate after decades of diplomatic gridlock, Rahman argues that glass-half-full perspective on Paris is actually dangerous because it threatens to diffuse the movement for real change in global climate politics.
I think it's not right for us as a movement to be applauding something if that then depoliticizes and takes away the power of the movement. So I very much say, if you're rooted in the global south, then you would not be celebrating Paris.
To which Salim Ul Haq might say, that's just the point. The Paris Agreement means for the first time, addressing climate change doesn't have to mean a fight between global north and south. It could mean we're all finally in this together. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
So as you probably know, I was in Kenya for 2 weeks reporting on women there who are owning it, whether it's running their own business or breaking into a job once a domain of men. It was encouraging to see how things are changing for women in that part of the world, real change, in many cases triggered by women. It was also a reminder that women everywhere around the globe still struggle to own it. Even here, yes, even here in the States, which reminds me of that wonderful documentary, 20 Feet from Stardom. Singer Darlene Love was one of the backup singers featured in the film, struggling for years to get the recognition she deserves. What we're hearing, by the way, is Love singing her signature Christmas tune, Christmas Baby Please Come Home, on David Letterman's show last December. Darlene Love had been doing that for 28 years, every Christmas Eve on Letterman. As she remembered, it was a ritual.
Christmas doesn't start until he hears Darlene Love sing that song.
Well,
But Letterman retired back in May, so Darlene Love's streak on his show is over. Her diehard fans don't have to go without her holiday singing, though. They can still come to her to watch her live. And they do, from all over the globe. Like this one woman Darlene Love knows, who regularly hauls over from the other side of the world to catch Love's holiday show in New York City.
She's from Japan, and she comes, and she doesn't even speak that, you know, great English, but she comes over every year. We play at B.B. King's to see me do my Christmas show. We have some people that come in every year from London just to see the show. We've been trying to get it, my Christmas show, out of the United States. It hasn't worked, but believe me when I tell you, it eventually will. Then I won't be able to come home anymore. I'll be doing it in all overseas.
Not that being on the road is unfamiliar turf for her. As we saw in 20 Feet from Stardom, Love spent decades as one of the most in-demand backup singers in rock and roll.
I've been overseas many times, but not as Darlene Love. As a backup singer with Tom Jones, Dionne Warwick, Cher, you know, so they all, they're very savvy in Europe. They know me. They know my career. They know my singing.
So I know it's not Christmas Eve, but we're in the mood, so here's Darlene Love to take us out today. If you're somewhere overseas and hearing this, make this a Christmas wish for next year. Darlene Love, bringing the song to you. That'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.